I thought I would talk tonight about choice. And I have to say that I'm not sure why I've chosen the topics I've chosen tonight and on Saturday. But here we are, so we'll hope it's relevant somehow. There's a somebody mentioned the other day, I forget who, the Book of Joy. I don't know how familiar you are with that book. It was given, it was loaned to me when I went out to Fugen Hermitage at the end of December, and I spent the first 2.5 days there just reading straight through it. Somehow it was just the right thing at the right time. I don't think it's the best book in the world, but it's certainly worth reading. It's the retelling of a week that the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, spent together in Dharamsala talking about joy. I mean, what a great topic, huh? And, you know, for those of, I think, you know, you may know, Desmond Tutu is the Archbishop of Southern Africa, which seems to be different from South Africa. I think it's the southern part of South Africa. And when apartheid ended there and Nelson Mandela was elected president, Nelson Mandela asked him to be the facilitator for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that he set up. And the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, Mandela, and forgive me if I'm repeating what you already know, but he was quite convinced that the only way that you were going to have a successful South Africa was if you brought all the factions together, rather than one ruled the other. You know, black rule wasn't going to be any better than white rule unless everybody was equally recognized. And so the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was part of his way of facilitating this. And the deal was that it brought the victims of apartheid and the perpetrators together. And, you know, the victims of apartheid suffered immensely, partly just because of the depth of the discrimination and the poverty and backwardness of their lives, and while, you know, the ruling class was wealthy and lived well and had all the privilege and ran the government and all of that. And then in the process of all this, a lot of people were murdered, killed, jailed, tortured for long periods of time. Nelson Mandela himself spent 27 years in jail, and not under very good conditions. And so the idea was to bring the victims and the perpetrators together and tell each other's story. And perpetrators would not be prosecuted if they came to these gatherings and heard what the victims had to say. And that, I think that was quite extraordinary. To me, it was one of the more amazing things that's occurred on this planet. And it was also amazing to see what happened, because when people came and told their stories, there was this kind of forgiveness that flowed from the victims that, to me, is incredible, because of, you know, how much they suffered, and some of them had lost their, you know, their sons, whoever, you know, relatives. A lot of harm had been caused to the victims, and yet they were able to forgive their perpetrators in the context of these gatherings, which to me is quite amazing. So I just say all that so you have, you know, and so it was Desmond Tutu who was facilitating this, so you have some sense of what he offered, you know, in the process of attempting to find reconciliation in South Africa after what had been, you know, a very long period of really brutal regime. Anyway, so these two very respected spiritual leaders, world spiritual leaders, came together to talk about joy. And I think I may have mentioned to you, I said this to somebody, that a couple of the monks at the Abbey have said to me, you know, joy isn't something you have any control over. It's something that arises spontaneously. And I think that's true about a certain kind of joy, you know, where, oh, you know, you you walk outside and there's this almost full moon, and you know, Kim and I had this experience tonight. We walked out of his house, there's this almost full moon shining through the branches of the trees with clouds around it, you know, and it was just gorgeous, you know, and you just sort of, your spirit wells up, yeah. And I think there's another kind of joy that actually underlies, we've talked about, or I've talked about this with you before, I think, underlies everything so that it can be cultivated. It actually is cultivatable. It's not something you have to wait to have happen to you. We can practice it. And it is not dependent on conditions. So it can be present no matter what the conditions are. And I said this the other day, that if we're truly with our experience and what's happening right now, that kind of joy can be present even when what's happening is really painful. And it's that kind of joy that I think they were trying to address. And something that, you know, the Dalai Lama said is deeper than this happy, you know, he's always talking about happiness and how everybody wants to be happy, and so we want to help others be happy as well as support our own happiness and not think that other beings are happy to be mistreated by us, you know, and that sort of thing. So it's that kind of joy that I think that they're trying to address. But they had this interesting, there's this thread through the book of this interesting banter disagreement that they had between them. And that was that the archbishop kept maintaining, you know, that we're human beings and human beings are imperfect, which is of course true. And so what we would call defiling emotions, defiling passions arise, and they arise unbidden, and we don't have any control over their arising, and so we aren't bad people. It's just that this is what happens to us, and it would be good if we didn't turn ourselves into bad people because it happens, or feel guilty, or beat ourselves up for it. Can we turn the heat down? Forgive me for interrupting, but it's, to me, really hot in here, and of course, I'm the one who's talking, so I'm going to be hot, but... So we're just human beings, and we can't help this. And the Dalai Lama, of course, you know, in Buddhism, there's this... teaching that there are practices that convert these defiling passions, and we can eradicate them. Forgive me, that's kind of a strong word. And when you've eradicated them completely, that's when you're enlightened, or when you're Buddha or something like that. But in any case, we can train ourselves so that these defiling passions or destructive emotions arise less and less, right? And I think we've all probably experienced that occurring as we train over the years, to some extent. So they're kind of, you know, bantering over this. But what the Dalai Lama is saying is, yes, we have a choice, that we're not victims of our, you know, the stuff that just arises in us, but we can make choices, and through those choices actually train destructive passions and cause less harm. Okay? And part of that is that we can choose joy. So what I guess I want to turn our attention towards is, what else can we choose? You know, in Soto Zen teaching, there's a constant or an ongoing creative tension between our meditation practice, which, to use Joko Beck's way of talking about it, we sit with whatever arises and we don't do anything about it. Okay, it's that simple. Just let it be. Sit with that whatever arises and don't do anything about it. Don't judge or criticize it. Don't try to fix it. Don't try to change it. Just let it be as it is. Okay? And on the other hand, our practice with the precepts, which tell us to act, think, or feel like this and not like that. And So there's the implied work of constantly trying to improve ourselves, to keep the precepts better, you know, so to not be angry, to be less greedy, you know, all of that. So I think we're familiar with this kind of tension, where on the one hand, we're just being with what is, and on the other hand, we're trying to make ourselves better people in accordance with the precepts, or you know, to follow the Dalai Lama's line of thinking, to decrease the arising of the defiling passions, right? And then there was that book, that little bit I read from Master Ma's Ordinary Mind. If you're irritated, just be irritated, and if a situation's irritating, well, then it's irritating, you know, which kind of goes along with Joe Beck's way of viewing this, right? So to me, we're kind of being told, don't choose, yes, choose, you know. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay, so leave it as it is. No, do something about it. And this kind of reminded me of a number of years ago, we did a day retreat on the topic of mindfulness here. And part of what I was trying to say during that retreat was that mindfulness can be the kind of practice where it seems like what we do is we're just paying attention, you know, being kind of the essence of mindfulness, and we're just paying attention to whatever is here, right? And that it's a kind of passive practice because we're not doing anything about anything. You know, where does action arise out of that? And what I was trying to say was that mindfulness, and part of the reason that secular mindfulness doesn't work very well for me, though I'm happy for people to use it skillfully if it's helpful, you know, because for me, and what my understanding of mindfulness in the way the Buddha talked about it is that we're paying attention, but then there's another step, because this paying attention actually shows us, without us having to work very hard at it, what skillful action would be or what helpful action would be. And out of mindfulness arises this skillful action. And that the mindfulness acts as a substratum for action which will actually help. And then out of activity or action, we return then to the stillness of mindfulness, and there's this feedback loop between them, okay? So let's say we're a human rights lawyer and we notice a violation of human rights because we're paying attention, but then we make the decision to prosecute it and, you know, go ahead and take it to court and all of that. So we're doing something that we think will help in response to paying attention and seeing clearly what's going on in a given situation. So it's not just passively sitting around, but actually, you know, acting in daily life. So it's an engagement with our lives. So meditation and precepts together, hyphenated, mm-hmm. which is undivided harmonious functioning. And to me, that's, well, anyway, yeah. So I wanted to go back to the Mobius strip, which I used when, again, years ago, we did our retreat on Buddhism and gender. We talked about women in Buddhism. And I used this actually to demonstrate the relationship between wisdom and compassion and how one arises out of the other. But you all know what a Mobius strip is? So you've got a strip of paper, and if it has two different sides, that's helpful because you can tell which side is which. And you put a single twist in it, not a full twist, and then you join them together. I think my tape's not very sticky anymore, but you join them together. And then if you take a pencil or your finger and you start drawing a line down the middle, what happens is that you go along and you go along, and eventually you get to the other side of the paper. Sorry, I'm going to have to, you know. So, And then if you keep going along that side of the paper, you get back to the first side of the paper. So when they're like this, it's like ne'er the twain shall meet, right? You can't get from one to the other. But when you join them like that, they turn into each other.
Is the universe supposed to be?
A Möbius strip? Could well be. That would be cool. That would explain a lot.
That the universe, that something Einstein would sort of put forward, that's kind of how the universe is. It's both sides and one at the same time.
So I'm going to say, you know, I use this to demonstrate how compassion turns into wisdom, and wisdom turns into compassion, or one leads to the other, or one grows out of the other. Actually, the yin-yang symbol is a really wonderful illustration of that as well. And I'm going to say more about this, so hold that thought. But in the meantime, I want to shift over to Reverend Master Hario gave recently to the lay ministers during their retreat at Shasta Abbey this fall. And he, in the middle of his talk, he began talking about transmutation. This was this word he used. And appropriately for the theme of this retreat, he said, ordinary mind transmutes into Buddha mind. And what he was saying was, where, you know, the way that he explained it was that this is not that transmute is a word that comes from alchemy, you know, in this attempt to turn lead into gold, but that's a metaphor for how we purify our essence and become Buddha, in effect, right? Becoming in accord with the way, that would be a more Taoist way to put it. But he was using it, you know, what he was saying was transmuting isn't about changing something, it's about seeing it differently. Yeah. And when we see it differently, that's the transmutation. So ordinary mind becomes the Buddha mind because we're looking differently. And it reminds me, and again, this is an example I use periodically, but you know that picture that looks like a duck or a rabbit, depending on how you look at it? Some of you are familiar with that. And it, you know, the picture doesn't change, but you show it to some people and they say, oh yeah, there's a rabbit, and you show it to other people and they say, oh yeah, there's a duck. But if the same person keeps looking at it, you see how it is both, depending on how you look at it. Okay? So, and then there's this story that Jo Gobek tells in her book of the monk who's being chased by a tiger. And in desperation, he jumps off a cliff and grabs a vine. And he's hanging by this vine over this cliff with the tiger at the top, right, wanting to eat him. And he looks down, and at the bottom is another tiger, you know, growling up at him, wanting to eat him. So if he falls or drops off the vine, the other tiger is going to get him. So there he is in this dilemma, and he notices this ripe strawberry just over there. And he picks the strawberry, and he eats it, and he says, oh, so delicious. I love that story. I'm sorry?
Present moment.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and you know, it's this amazing ability to be in, you know, to see what's right there, that's, and to appreciate the deliciousness of the strawberry when you're in the midst of this dire situation. You know, you're about to lose your life. So the shift of focus, you know, is what I find so amazing. And that's part of what I'm trying to get at with the Möbius strip, you know, that here you are, you have this beautiful colored pattern, and then there you are on the white part. And it's kind of like that it's the same kind of shift of focus, right? Okay? And, you know, actually, this is a bit of an aside, but Joko suggests that this is perhaps what happens when we get close to death. And we see that we can no longer hang on to anything. This is assuming you don't die instantly. And so we just, you know, we let go. There's nothing we can do anymore about anything. And so we relax into the present moment and are at peace as we die. And, you know, Darling Singh also talks that her nearing death experience is really a description, I think, of that kind of shift. Yeah. Anyway, for those of you who aren't familiar with that, don't worry about it. So I also think that, I know that this same kind of shift moves us from suffering into bliss or from samsara into nirvana. You know, we say that samsara and nirvana are the same, or, you know, the bodhisattva is someone who plays in the garden of samsara and in effect is in nirvana in doing that. It's not a matter of getting away from samsara and into this place that we think of as nirvana, some kind of perfect place or cessation of whatever, but just shifting our view or our focus or the way that we're seeing it, the way we're looking at it. Okay, compassion and wisdom, painful emotions and joy, defiling passions in the purified mind, you know, everyday mind and the Buddha mind, all these kind of opposites that we set up, if we transmute them by the way that we're looking, they transform. Okay? So what this leads me to is that we are completely free at any moment in our life to choose. And that choice is about how we choose to see what we're in the midst of. So we can see the tigers yapping, or we can see and taste the strawberry. And from moment to moment, we can make that choice. So when someone approaches us, do we see Buddha or do we see devil? When we're washing the dishes, do we see the plate is a Buddha? Is the act of washing dishes Buddha? You know, or drudgery, that kind of thing. Joko Beck, I'm sorry, I keep coming back to her for some reason, puts it like this. She says, you cannot avoid paradise. You can only avoid seeing it. And I think that's really interesting. Wisdom is to see that there is nothing to search for. If you live with a difficult person, that's nirvana. Perfect. If you're miserable, that's also nirvana. And I'm not saying to be passive, not to take action. Then you would be trying to hold nirvana in a fixed state. And I think that's an interesting perspective. To be passive is actually to hold nirvana in a fixed state. So this isn't actually a very profound Dharma talk. All I'm saying is that, are we seeing the glass half full or half empty? Now, I'm teasing when I say, you know, when I talk about the profundity or not of the Dharma talk, but in some sense, it's simply that. You know, there's that little metaphor, you know, the glass half full or half empty has been tremendously rich for me in my life of training, because I've spent most of my life noticing the 1% empty and not the 99% full. And it's just simply a shift in seeing, right? I mean, it's the same glass of milk. And we can mourn the half emptiness or rejoice in the half fullness, and we can make that choice in each moment. Okay, so to shift gears a little, just a little bit more, and to go back to joy, we do have practices for cultivating joy. So there are ways in which we can approach it. And one is to simply make that shift, to choose to see the half full rather than the half empty. Mindfulness is, I think, crucial, a sort of sine qua non foundation. And it's like, you know, we have, if we're going to notice, the way we were talking the other day, Saturday, if we're going to notice that we've got an opinion that's causing damage, we have to notice that we have an opinion. So we have to start with some level of awareness. And mindfulness gives us that ability to make the choice in each moment. You know, oh, I could make this choice here. The precepts are an obvious guide for keeping us on the rails, you know, kind of coarse, obvious guide for keeping us on the rails. Actually, when you get to the subtle levels, they're not so coarse. And I personally find it helpful to consciously practice loving kindness and sympathetic joy. Both of those Brahma Viharas cut through, you know, anger, irritation, negativity. Loving kindness helps me to appreciate somebody who's driving me crazy. The monk who sits next to me in the meditation hall comes to meditation late every single time. And every single time, I get mad at this person in my mind. And I just say, may they be well and happy. May they be free from suffering. May I be well and happy. And actually, it really helps to offer it towards myself. And you're supposed to offer it to yourself first, you know. Because I think, you know, here I am all upset about this. And of course, I'm thinking, boy, are you a lousy monk. You're all upset about this totally trivial thing. So then I make myself, I sort of, you know, having that wish that I be happy, it's really kind of lovely, you know. And then I offer it to them, and I, you know, and that makes me think of all the things I appreciate about these people, this person. And it helps to shift it. And sympathetic joy, you know, is joyful to begin with, and appreciating somebody else's success or, you know, what something they've received or something they're happy about or some honor they've gotten can cheer you up, you know. Instead of being jealous, it can cheer you up. So those two practices. And then in this book, The Book of Joy, the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu spend a chapter each talking about eight characteristics that you can cultivate that support joy. And so I thought I'd just mention them. And I won't talk about them in depth or we'd be here all night. But they are, I'll just mention, you know, a bit about each one. And we can practice developing these characteristics, which are a cause and support for joy. The first one is perspective. And I find this one interesting in terms of, again, coming back to opinions or ideas or ideals, views. Perspective, there are both different angles from which to see something other than the one we're looking from. And there's a way to widen perspective. And the more we widen perspective, the more we widen perspective, the happier we get. There's almost a direct correlation, I think. We're able to allow so much more in with it being less threatening. So that's the first one. The second is humility. And my into that is pride and arrogance are painful. It takes a lot of effort to sustain arrogance, you know. And so let them go, and joy has some room to enter, right? Humor. Can we laugh at ourselves, you know, and our humanity, you know, and the silly things we get up to, or can we laugh at ourselves in difficult situations? And can we laugh at ourselves when what we've gotten up to isn't so very silly, but has actually caused a lot of trouble, you know? And the laughing at ourselves isn't a call to be irresponsible, to not take responsibility what's for happening, but we can still, you know, kind of say, gosh, yeah, you know, that was kind of dumb, and now I need to clean up this mess. But, you know... And, of course, a sense of humor at any point brings some levity and joy to any situation, right? Acceptance, which is, in spite of how some of us may feel about that word, you know, the Dalai Lama characterizes it as the one place from which change can begin or be generated from. And there's a lot, I think there's a lot of truth in that. Forgiveness, which isn't a very, well, I was going to say it's not a very Buddhist word, but that's not what I mean. What I mean is you don't find that word in kind of normal traditional Buddhist context much. It's more of a Christian word in a way. But you know, it's forgiveness is forgiveness is for ourselves more than the other person, and it's about freeing ourselves from the hold that the past has on us. And, you know, you can imagine that as a victim of apartheid, you could spend your life being resentful, hateful, vengeful, vindictive. You know, all of those are really painful states of mind. And forgiveness frees us from those painful states of mind. Gratitude, and of course we can see how joy arises out of gratitude, and the Dalai Lama suggests just being grateful that you're alive. Which, you know, sometimes I can think of some really good reasons not to be grateful I'm alive. But his advice is well taken, yeah. Compassion. Dealing with the suffering of others doesn't sound like much fun, but what are our options, you know? And when we do, I mean, think of somebody like Mother Teresa in these horrific conditions, but you have the sense that her work brought a lot of joy to her, as well as, you know, to those she helped. And generosity. And you can see how, and especially generosity of spirit. And you can see how that kind of largesse or magnanimous mind can be a support for joy. And someday I'd like to give a talk on generosity of spirit, because I don't think I know anything about it. I think it would be interesting to explore. So, we're free to cultivate joy. Here's some ways we can do it. We can actually choose to cultivate it. We can choose to support it in our lives. We're free to shift our perspective and free to dance and play in the fields of nirvana if we choose to. Or we can choose to be miserable in the fields of samsara. And that these are all works in progress, right? You know, we may know this, but that doesn't make it all that easy to do. But the choice is available to us in every moment. And to me, there's something about this that is the crux of training in daily life. So back to our training in daily life topic, that it's the crux of everyday Zen, the bringing of Zen training into our everyday life. So that's what I have to say. Except that I do want to kind of issue a caveat regarding clinical depression, and there may be other things like this. I think that if somebody suffers from clinical depression, and I don't know a whole lot about it, making this kind of choice may be literally impossible. And that, yeah, and that we, and even when I'm in a state of despair, you know, depression isn't my thing, and despair is a thing that I flirt with, but isn't, you know, I have anger and other stuff like that instead. But clinical depression, Sue's nodding, Carol's nodding her head, and yeah. And I don't want to be critical or condemn anyone for whom that's so. It's too glib to just say, oh, well, anybody can do this, and why aren't we all joyful all the time, you know? I'm not trying to say that, you know. And so, so we have to keep in mind that there are conditions under which this is incredibly difficult to impossible, and not be judgmental about that, either of ourselves or others.